This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to the show. Have you ever wondered about those near-death experiences we hear about? You know the ones I mean, where people are drawn to a white light or to voices of deceased family members. Or maybe you've encountered a spiritual experience of your own that defies explanation. Well, today we're talking about when medicine and spirit converge. And I'm looking at the jacket of the book we're talking about today, and I want to just read this to you. This is what this is about. A doctor discovers he can predict when a patient will die. A clinically dead patient later recounts extraordinary details about the private lives of her caregivers. A young burn victim remains in a coma until a ghost appears. And a physician needs the help of a Navajo shaman to exorcise the spirit of his dead patient. Well, according to my guest, these things really happened. And what might surprise you is that this book, The Scalpel and the Soul, is written by a man of science. Dr. Alan Hamilton is my guest. He's a renowned Harvard-trained neurosurgeon. He practiced in Boston, Massachusetts, and then went on to become the chief of neurosurgery and chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Arizona Health Sciences Center. He's currently a professor of neurosurgery and clinical professor in the departments of radiation oncology and psychology, and is also the executive director of the Arizona Simulation Technology and Education Center, which is a medical think tank. In addition, Dr. Hamilton is a script consultant for neurosurgery for the popular television show Grey's Anatomy. Dr. Alan Hamilton, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Vicki. It's nice to be with you.
I'm glad to have you here, and I know that you like to go by Alan, so we're going to call you Alan. But so I want to start at the beginning, Alan. You haven't always wanted to be a doctor. I read, in fact, that at one point you actually wanted to be a cowboy, but you say that in the end surgery chose you, and I'm wondering how. How did surgery choose you?
Well, the good news is I did become a cowboy. I run a ranch in Arizona and train horses. But what I meant was I really looked at I wanted to be a painter, and I loved working with my hands when I was a kid. I used to always love building model ships. And for me, that was sort of how I got into the, you know, flow state where I really was happy and absorbed and that kind of thing. And that was what attracted me not only to surgery, but specifically to brain surgery, which sort of demands the ultimate in fine motor and hand technique.
Yeah, you can't make mistakes that are easily rectifiable in brain surgery, can you?
You can't take them back. It's not like a piece of bowel or a muscle or even the heart. Once you make a mistake in the brain, it's irrevocable.
Yeah. I want to go back to the beginning of your career. You went to Africa as a medical fellow, and that trip spurred a huge turning point in your life. Here you are, a Harvard-trained scientist practicing to be a surgeon. And you came across your first encounter with the subconscious instructions of a dream. I wonder if you'd share that story with our listeners.
Well, you know, I was fresh out of Harvard, and I'm sure I had the swelled head to go with it. And I got assigned to go to the hospital that Albert Schweitzer founded in Gabon, Africa. And one of the tasks that we had to do was go out in the wet season to these isolated villages. They don't have many roads, so in the wet season, the river system allows us to get to these isolated villages. And that was one of my assignments, was to immunize some children there. We, in order to do this, we used a boat, and it's actually kind of a kind of overstatement. It's like a hollowed out log with an outboard motor on it, and you strap everything in. And I got the boat ready, and I didn't realize how fast the river would come up. And during the night, I had it tied up to shore. And in the morning, when I was ready to depart, the boat was gone. And we had to search downriver to find it, bring it back, re-outfit it. So the result of this was I was delayed a day in getting off. And we went down this river, And because the river was so swollen, we really couldn't see the usual landmarks. And we knew we were going to come to a branch point in the river, and one side was going to lead us to the Atlantic Ocean, which isn't where we wanted to go, and the other was going to take us to these villages. And the rule was you just take the larger fork. We didn't know which one it was, but as you know, chance would have it, when we got there, they were absolutely identical. And, of course, we had to make a decision pretty quickly because the river was carrying us so fast. We didn't know left or right.
Sure.
So finally, we just made the decision to crash land in the fork and try to scamper up this muddy slope and drag the boat behind us before we lost it. And we managed to get up there, and we're lying on the ground panting. And suddenly you look up, and there's this very dignified, beautiful, majestic African man with just a halo of beautiful hair. And I look up to him and I say, oh, thank God, you know, we're lost. And he says, I know. And I go, what? And I said, no. We're looking for this village we have to go to. And he says, I know, that's why I'm here. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, I had a dream, and in my dream it told me that you would be lost, and the dream told me to come here and wait for you in the fork in the river. And then he says, you know, the funny thing is, the dream told me to be here yesterday. And, you know, he had no way, there were no radios or smoke signals or mm-hmm. cell phones. There was no way we could have let him know we were delayed a day. And, you know, there I am lying in the mud, and I'm thinking to myself, so my ability to carry out a medical mission now is dependent on the dream of a perfect stranger and dependent on his faith in that dream to actually follow through on it and then wait for 24 hours for us to come. And that sort of blew me away. That really violated everything that I knew about how the world works. And I think that was just sort of the first of many experiences in Africa that made me sort of rethink how we're connected to the universe.
Yeah, you said that you lost a lot of your faith in science in Africa. How did that impact you as a Harvard-trained doctor?
It shook me up. I had all these wonderful rules and analyses, and then I'd watch people die inexplicably from taboos and curses. I literally worked side by side on, and sometimes with witch doctors and medicine men, and you know, it was just, I was in a world that was infused with the power of the supernatural, and that was not where I came from. Where I came from, the rules of the natural, the rules of science that predicted the natural, what ruled the day, and suddenly those rules seem to somehow, a lot of them go out the window.
Yeah, I read that in your third year of medical school, you came across another phenomenon. You were working with a patient. You noticed the yellow, waxy aura. Tell us about that and what that meant.
Yeah. This story always makes me it makes me cringe sometimes that I told it. But because people sort of, you know, say, oh, God, he can see light and predict when people die. That isn't what happens. But the way this story started out was I was actually working in a veterinary practice, and we would, unfortunately, have to euthanize many dogs and put them to sleep. And I would hold the dogs while the veterinarian would put them to sleep, and I became struck by this kind of strange light as they were taking their last breath that would just seem to collect around them. And I didn't think too much of it. You know, I'd seen it with animals, and that was that. And then when I was a third-year medical student, we were walking around the ICU one day, I see a patient that obviously is, you know, close to dying, and I sort of see this same kind of light. And I, you know, it's not like I walk around the hospital looking for people like this.
Sure.
And I don't see it all the time. But when I see it, I know that somebody's in very real trouble. And if I, you know, I've often had opportunities where I see that light and I go, okay, let's get this patient right down to CT. And people say, what's the matter? And I go, just believe me, take them down to CT. And, you know, we'll find they have a hemorrhage or something. And we go rushing to the OR. It's just one of these strange things, but fortunately, I don't walk around and see everybody who's close to dying or anything like that. It just sort of comes intermittently.
Right.
But it is a strange phenomenon, and I've talked now when I've gone around the country, and particularly to hospice nurses who have a lot of experience with people dying with them. when people came up from hospice and said, yes, we see that all the time. You know, the one outfit told me to have a cat, and the cat only comes around and sits on the bed when somebody is going to die in the next few minutes.
You know, I've heard similar stories to that, too.
Yeah, and it just amazed me, you know, that I was kind of glad I wasn't going to get committed to a nut house or something. But, you know, that's one phenomenon that I have noticed.
Mm. My sister actually has been worked in healthcare for many, many years, and she works with old people. She works with elderly people in residential homes, and she said mm-hmm. she always knows when they're going to die. And it is just a pallor to their skin, and she even says a smell that comes from the body. But
there really is. There is a kind of a yellowish light that just comes into them, and right, you know, as they're close to death.
Now, in your fourth year of medical school, mm-hmm. we're getting more exposed into the supernatural. Or you're getting more and more exposed to the supernatural.
Yeah, more here. And more shaken up.
You come across a patient called Harry, and he talks of a near-death experience. I wonder if you'd share that with us.
His near-death experience is actually very typical, and there's some things about the kind of stereotype of the near-death experience that interests me. What happened to Harry was he had a very significant heart attack and recovered from it and had this incredible near-death experience and came back absolutely ecstatic. I mean, to think of an individual is absolutely filled with awe at each living moment and each breath he took. That was how I would describe Harry. And he had been, had been on duty as a merchant marine during World War II and had lost many, many sailors in the ocean with different convoys in the U-boats. And he described the feeling that he had in the near-death experience as beautiful as if he was coming home from the war and finally knew he was safe amongst the people he loved. It sounded just, you know, so comforting. And I've seen that many, many times when patients have had near-death experiences. They've come back and said just this incredible sense of peace and love and comfort and safety.
Is our experience generally pretty much the same as far as, you know, we often hear of bright lights and mm-hmm. voices of deceased family members. Is that part of the experience pretty similar through those stories?
It's very common, and I think the thing that's kind of unusual about it is that it seems to be true over time. In other words, you would think that maybe cultural traditions and mores and sort of have changed, and yet the experience is very much the same. And it's true across different countries and cultures, which makes us wonder, you know, is there really some kind of common fundamental basis to all of this? It's interesting. I wrote an article many years ago to show you just what a doubting Thomas I was. I wrote an article for the Journal of Near-Death Experiences, and I said with my co-authors that I hypothesized that this experience was all related to the release of neurochemicals as we got closer to death. Now I'm kind of embarrassed by that hypothesis because it would be like I would say when we're scared, we all release adrenaline, and that if I gave you adrenaline, you would have exactly the same fears that I do, and yet you don't. If you're scared of snakes and I'm scared of the dark, when I give you a neurochemical, you don't have the identical experience. So,
right.
You know, it seems now I'm kind of having to withdraw what I said about 30 years ago as a doubting Thomas.
Well, it's a learning experience, right?
it's a
learning. And you believe now that, I mean, you've been practicing for a long time. You've been a neurosurgeon for a long time. You believe there are much worse things than death. But our culture, of course, does fear it. What are your views on death itself?
As a culture, we've pushed death as far away as we can. And obviously, in doing that, we've made it mortality and the whole notion of dying extremely fearful. One of the things that I remind patients about is that there are plenty of circumstances that we all have where we admit there are worse things than dying. And an example I give is if I see my child darting out into the street in front of an oncoming car, I don't hesitate for a moment to sacrifice my life and say I'm going to die in order to have this happen. So we already have premises that we know I'd much rather die, and I'm not as afraid of that. Mm. So I sort of like to build on that because I think death, in a way, is a wonderful thing as a yardstick to remind us how to live, what's important to us. I always tell residents, you know, I've been with a lot of people when they were close to dying, and I've never had one of them say, geez, I wish I had spent more time at the office.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. So I think death sort of reminds us, you know, what's our legacy, what are we leaving, what's important to us. It sort of brings everything into perspective, and it's a very useful way of keeping ourselves on track. Unfortunately, we don't have the experience of watching people die very much in our culture anymore, and we sort of created a great taboo about it. So as we do that, we become more and more and more fearful because we have no acquaintance with it at all. Mm. I think a telling statistic is that 95% of us, when we are asked and polled, want to die at home. And yet 95% of us die in the hospital because very few people are comfortable taking care of somebody dying at home.
Mm. Well, I have been with two people as they've actually died. And when we're going to take a quick break, when we come back, I want to ask you what you think happens to us, you know, when that situation happens.
Great.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest today is Dr. Alan Hamilton. His new book is called The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, freelance writer Gene Eck in I'm Happier to Know You. Middle-aged, recently divorced, and facing critical midlife issues, Gene did what any sensible woman would do. She moved to Egypt. I'm Happier to Know You is the memoir of how an ancient culture changed Gene Eck's life and taught her to pursue her dreams. Both timely and timeless, it's the story of how one woman learned to live life at its fullest and honor her intuition. Most importantly, Gene Eck's work imparts the message that peace is built upon loving and healing ourselves. That's coming next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Vicky St. Clair and wanted to let you know about Book Talk, a weekly podcast brought to you by Conversations Live. In Book Talk, we'll be reviewing books from the eclectic to the banned to the challenging and, of course, to the easy and fun summer beach read. You can download Book Talk podcasts at 1150kknw.com under the podcast section of the site. If you'd like to be a guest reviewer for Book Talk, call me, Vicky, at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617, or drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net. Meanwhile, check out the latest Book Talk podcast at 1150kknw.com. Book Talk is brought to you by Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest today is Harvard-educated neurosurgeon. His new book is called The Scalpel and the Soul. And we're talking about when medicine and spirit converge. And my guest today has certainly had his fair share of encounters with the supernatural. And I wanted to ask you, Alan, you know, I've been with two people when they've actually died. Well, one I was with her seconds after she died. The other was my father, and I was actually with him as he died. And I can say very definitely for the first time I understood that expression that the body is just a vessel or a vehicle, because even though his body was laying there and I could touch it and feel it, my dad was not there. What is it you think happens to our spirit, or whatever you want to call it, you know, as we evaporate, as we cease to live?
I think we undergo, as best I understand it, I think when we look at experiences that bring us as close to the edge, so we might be just able to catch it, the first glimpse of that door opening, I think we transition over from a form where we leave the body behind. And, you know, we were talking in the break that, you know, I think it's very akin to, you know, we're in utero, we're a fetus, and we have this existence where we just are. And if somebody from the outside world was trying to explain to us what this life outside was like after birth, we'd have no context. We wouldn't know what color was. We wouldn't know what grass or trees or birds or dogs or being in love meant. None of that. And then, you know, then we come into this life and we go, oh, yeah, I know what that's like. I think the transition after we leave the body is just as incomprehensible to us as the prior example. I don't think we can really explain it. Mm-hmm. And yet we clearly see there's a moment where there's a presence and a consciousness, and then there's another moment where suddenly it's departed.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect it just means whatever that form of consciousness is, and maybe we can touch on that, because I have had one experience that sort of threw me for a loop, but gave me a little bit of insight into what consciousness might be.
Yeah, please share that.
I think consciousness departs. In this one particular case, we had a woman who required a repair on a complex vessel. And in order to do that, we sort of borrowed the idea that, you know, we hear about kids who, during the winter, they fall through the ice and they're cold. And when they're pulled out, they're pulseless and they appear to be dead, and yet they revive. So this is a kind of a variation on that. You put the patient on a heart-lung bypass pump, and then you gradually cool it off. And then the heart stops, and then when the patient's body's nice and cold, you just stop all blood flow and get to operate on the vessel without any bleeding, which makes it very quick. However, you have a very short window to do that in, because the brain has no blood flow, is receiving no oxygen, and all electrical activity is gone. We know that from scalp electrodes. During the surgery. In this particular case, we did this procedure and everything went very, very smoothly. Yeah, about 20 minutes. And we were about 10 minutes in, and then the repair was pretty much done the way we needed to. So we were wrapping up and everybody sort of relaxed. And one of the nurses was just having a casual conversation saying, oh, you know, this weekend I got engaged and we went to this particular restaurant. And she even told an episode that when her fiance was down on his knees, the waiter tripped going past him.
Right.
So, you know, there's right. some details like that. And then after we, you know, the surgery went well and we started the pump back up and we warmed the patient up and everything went very smoothly. And afterwards, many hours afterwards, I went to see her in the ICU and when we're talking, and then all of a sudden she's telling me, you know, I had some kind of weird experiences while during the surgery. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, I remember this hearing this conversation, and she is giving me this woman's engagement story word for word. I mean, right down to the name of the restaurant and where they bought the engagement ring, every single detail. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, this is impossible. I mean, I have in front of me scientific evidence that her brain had absolutely no electrical activity at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no way the brain can make memory without electrical activity. So it begs the question of, well, where were these memories made if they weren't made in her brain? And it just starts raising the whole question of a consciousness that's completely separate, if you will, from the mind and the brain that are based on electrical activity. So, you know, I don't know whether, you know, that's as close as I may have gotten to the Holy Grail of finding a soul, but that one is one I can't scientifically explain, and yet I have in front of me, you know, the evidence of the woman, while she was brain dead, she somehow make a memory somewhere and bring it back into her brain after the electrical activity return.
Interesting. Do you think sometimes people just want to die? And I'll tell you why I ask that. You know, mm-hmm. I had an uncle in critical care for the last 4 weeks. He was 84, but, you know, a fairly robust kind of fellow. Mm-hmm. He had major heart surgery, and they kept him asleep for 5 days and purposely so he could recover. And he never woke up, basically. Mm-hmm. And the neurosurgeon, heart doctors, some of the best specialists in California could not find any reason why he would not wake up. And, you know, we tell ourselves as family members to cope with the situation. Well, he knew he had a stroke during surgery and he just didn't want to wake up. He didn't want to deal with it. Do you, I know obviously you can't comment on his situation, but I'm sure you've seen many similar kind of situations throughout your career as a neurosurgeon. Do you believe that we just get to that point sometimes where we've had enough and we want to move on?
One of the things that interest me is that medicine has a very hard time with accepting certain things. And it comes back to this example that you just gave from your own family. Every doctor has instances of a patient who says, I have to hang on until we get together at Christmas so I can say goodbye to my family. Or we had a woman up in the ICU who said, I can't go until my son is back from Iraq and I can talk to him. And none of us have a problem seeing this scores of times and saying, well, how does this happen? And the answer is the patient imposes their will. They marshal their emotional and spiritual resources to sustain themselves in the illness. We have no problem with that. But we seem to have a problem when we look at it the other way, which is when the patient lets go, when the patient says, okay, I'm withdrawing my resources. There are many patients who simply just will themselves to death, almost, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly within the Native American cultures, that's not unusual at all, that a Native American will say to his family, it's time for me to go, and I want to say goodbye, and I'm ready to depart this world. And, you know, we in medicine, we don't have a problem understanding, for example, that people can die from a voodoo curse. We know, it's been very well researched, that somebody believes in voodoo, and they can be perfectly healthy if a curse is placed upon them in a matter of days, a perfectly healthy person dies.
And that's the key, but that's the key thing, isn't it? If they believe in it.
Well, if they can die because of their beliefs, then why can't they live because of their beliefs?
Right.
I don't understand. Medicine seems to have a problem accepting the positive side of that equation, but is perfectly willing to accept the downside. We know that depressed patients, isolated patients, are at much higher risk for complications and dying than patients that have a very upbeat attitude and a good support system, and sometimes that includes a deep, abounding religious faith. I just sort of wonder sometimes why medicine doesn't want to talk about this, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, I wrote the book. I said, look, I was a reluctant surgeon. I thought about calling this book The Spiritual Journey of a Reluctant Surgeon because I was cold kicking and screaming.
Right, right. But obviously for a purpose. I mean, you know, maybe to enlighten other surgeons.
Well, certainly I felt as if there was something unusual about the fact that nobody had talked to me about this. Nobody. It was as if nobody wanted, you know, and yet when you talk to people one-on-one or talk to nurses and say, have you seen things you can't explain? Have you seen miracles that just absolutely seem medically impossible? They all say, yes. And then I go, well, why don't we talk about it? And they go, why don't we open a dialogue about it? And they say, well, we don't want to look crazy.
Mm.
And yet we're all seeing it. I'm sure these things are happening every single day in every hospital in the country, in the world. And it's as if it's a taboo topic. Interestingly enough, I sent a copy of the book to every single one of my surgical teachers. Not one of them sent me a thank you, an email, or anything, because it's as if I've, oh my God, what's he doing writing this book? I had one surgical colleague coming up and said, I can't believe you did this. You were chairman of surgery and all of this. And then he turned and said, on the other hand, whenever something goes wrong with my children, I always know it before the phone rings.
Mm.
And I kind of went, duh.
Well, yeah.
So.
Yeah. You write in the book that it's easy to say you don't believe in ghosts when you've never seen one. And you talk about a burn patient that you worked with. I wonder if you'd share that story.
Well, I was working with a young boy who was severely burned and had been in a coma since the moment of that he was burned. He was burned all over, almost all over his body. And had been on a ventilator, eyes closed, not responding. He started rejecting one skin graft after another, and that becomes very ominous with a burn patient because you can't keep them covered. And he had abscesses, and he was dying. And in the midst of this, tragically, his father, who was in his mid-40s, died of a heart attack. And you know, whether this was involved with the stress of what was going on with his son or not, we'll never know. But the mother had the presence of mind to say, you know, we're in the midst of this tragedy, but would there be any benefit to using the grafts from his father to help cover the son, Thomas? And, you know, it was a last-ditch effort, and the doctors were all arguing, you know, oh, it's not worth it, we're going to spend a lot of money, and other people said, no, it's the last chance he has. Long story short, we harvested the grafts from his father and put them on him, but by that time, it took me about 36 hours without sleep, and I went to bed in the on-call room, and about 2.5 hours later or so, the nurse is pounding on the door, and it sounded like something terrible was wrong, and she said, excuse me, Thomas is waking up and is trying to talk. And I just said, that's impossible. He's been on a ventilator for a month. He's never woken up.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe something was wrong with the ventilator and they had made a mistake. So I ran out, and sure enough, this boy, even though his hands are bandaged, is trying very hard to get the breathing tube out of his windpipe so he can talk. So I make a decision, and again, I was at the very beginning of my career because I made a very serious blunder here. I took the tube out, and he opens his eyes. It's the very first time we've looked at each other's eyes, let alone talk to each other. And the very first question out of his mouth is, what's happened to my dad? And I'm just floored. I'm going, I can't. The first words out of my mouth to this kid cannot be, your father died. So I lied. And I said, your father's fine. And then the next thing he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah. Why? And he said, well, why is my father standing at the end of the bed smiling at me and not saying a word? So I whip around and look at the end of the bed, and, you know, I can't see anything. It's empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I, all of a sudden, the enormity of what I've done just kind of rushes in on me, and I said, Thomas, I got to tell you something terrible, and that is that your father passed away. He died. And then the boy says, well, that must be his spirit. That must be his ghost, and it's smiling at me at the end of the bed. And Thomas went on to make a miraculous recovery. And in fact, this was my intern year, so I was doing residency for another 9 years, and it was the very last day of my residency. I'm going up in the elevator to the communications office was on the 12th floor, and I'm going to drop my beeper off for the very last time. And I get on the elevator, and I see a woman that I recognize. Don't know where to place her, and standing next to her is a teenager who obviously had been a burn victim. And all of a sudden, I realize this is the mother that we knew from harvesting the grass, and this has got to be Thomas. And I'm thinking to myself, this can't be a coincidence. And on the very last day of my residency, 10 years later, there's Thomas on the elevator. It's as if, you know, the universe was just sort of saying, don't you forget this. Don't you make less of this than what it really is. You participated in a miracle. You've seen things, and don't sweep it under the rug.
Interesting. We're going to take a break when we come back. I want to ask you why you wrote this book, because, as you said, it's not commonly talked about amongst surgeons. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay with us. We will be right back.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Vicki St. Clair and wanted to let you know about Book Talk, a weekly podcast brought to you by Conversations Live. In Book Talk, we'll be reviewing books from the eclectic to the banned to the challenging and, of course, to the easy and fun summer beach read. You can download Book Talk podcasts at 1150kknw.com under the podcast section of the site. If you'd like to be a guest reviewer for Book Talk, call me, Vicki, at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net. Meanwhile, check out the latest Book Talk podcast at 1150kknw.com. Book Talk is brought to you by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Hi, this is Howard Bono, the host of The Money Thing, heard right here on Tuesdays at noon. You don't need to know everything about money, but there are some things you really should know. Each week, my co-host Gary Mance and I will bring you the information that you need. We cut through all the verbiage and marketing hype to provide you with an hour of condensed, easy-to-understand information. We want to improve the quality of your life by taking the financial stress away. So join us for The Money Thing, Tuesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest today is Dr. Alan Hamilton, and his new book is called The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope. And I wanted to ask you, Alan, why you did write this book, because as a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon, a scientist, I'm sure you kind of touched on this a little bit, that people in your business don't want to discuss this at large. So why did you write this? Why did you risk being ridiculed, if you like, to some extent by people who are scientists?
Well, I think first that I wanted to ensure that patients and their families and their physicians sort of felt empowered to get into this dialogue about how we harness our emotional and spiritual resources. I think that's vital. And I think patients often want to talk about this, and their physicians are sort of stalled a little bit. And I was hoping that this book would finally say, look, the dialogue is open. It's okay to talk about this. It's okay to address these things. Mm. I think the second thing was I felt as if in medicine we had sort of not approached this with medical students and residents, and that was one of the things that took me aback. I was totally unprepared for how challenged I would be spiritually by what I was going through with my patients and what they were sharing with me, that my values would be called upon. And I just, you know, really felt it was a time to start talking about it, because the patients needed it, and I thought the doctors needed it.
And you've been known to cancel surgery if a patient tells you he's feeling unlucky or has dreamt about death. And you gave an incident in the book of you dreamt of buzzards, and you canceled that surgery the following day when it was buzzards and a bunny, if I recall the dream correctly.
Yeah, a bunny, a jackrabbit.
Okay.
I think I was, the world speaks to us. People sort of say, what's intuition? And you've got to come down to it's a sense of the world way that you can't logically analyze, and in some ways a way that's beyond your senses. In this particular situation, I was driving to work to get ready to, you know, early in the morning, and I live in the desert in Tucson, Arizona, so I'm driving down the highway, and I see this dead jackrabbit that's been hit on the road, and then I see these three, buzzards that are basically tearing the rabbit to shreds, and I'm kind of shaken up. That's not the sort of thing you just drive by and forget. I go into work. I'm getting ready to start the day. I go in to see my first patient with his wife and tell him, you know, everything's ready, and I'll see you in the operating room a little later. And I'm leaving the room, and then I hear the wife getting ready to say goodbye, and she leans over to her husband and kisses him on the cheek and says, "Goodbye, my little bunny. I hope that you're going to be just fine." And I'm thinking, bunny, and all of a sudden this image connects in my head. So I went out to the front desk, and there's a nurse there that I know, and I said, "Look, don't ask me any questions, but I'm going to change the order of the cases. And I just want to delay this guy a little bit later. I just got a funny feeling." And it turned out that a few hours later, this man had a large heart attack and was almost died. And he certainly would have died had I been in the midst of brain surgery with him. So, people say, "Well, you know, how'd you know that?" And I go, "Oh, nothing. It just was one of these things, and I was real lucky." But, you know, we operated on him 6 weeks later, and he was fine. But had I not been sort of tuned in a little bit to that omen, I could have had a real disaster on my hands. And I was very grateful that I sort of got this very funny feeling and just delayed the case.
Mm. Amazing. You've got some amazing stories in here. And the last one I'd like you to share with our listeners, and then I'd like to look at the section of the book you have, 20 Rules to Live By. But you had an issue with your back, and you talk of the story of Charlie and Alfred and the Navajo shaman. I wonder if you'd share that story with us.
The Navajo shaman?
Mm.
This was unusual because I want you to see this, and I want the listeners to understand this in the context of being a brain surgeon. I had taken care of a young boy I got very close to, and he was dying of a brain tumor. And I had seen him through to the very end, and as I said, I was very close to him. The next morning, I'd actually taken some days off to be there. So the next morning I was home, and I was reaching for a cup of coffee, and suddenly I just felt like I was sort of struck by lightning. I was just absolutely knocked to the floor. I thought I was paralyzed or something. I was just in excruciating pain, and I couldn't move. I didn't even dare take a breath. So I'm lying there on the floor and kind of, you know, screaming for help, and my wife sort of gets me stabilized and everything else, and there's a knock on the door. I think it's the UPS guy or whatever, and in comes an old friend of mine who's a Navajo, and he leans over me and says, "I'm going to get help." And I thought, you know, he's going to get an ambulance, bring a, you know, I don't know, stretcher, I have no idea.
Right.
He returns a few, you know, with a very elderly Navajo medicine man who only speaks Navajo, so my friend is doing the translation, and here I am lying on the floor thinking, you know, I've ruptured a disc or I'm paralyzed or what have you, and he starts to minister to me, and he all of a sudden at a certain point he says, "Well, now you can get up." And I thought, "Well, I can't get up, my legs aren't working." And then all of a sudden, you know, he says, "No, get up," and I could feel that, you know, yeah, I can move. I'm kind of surprised. And then he says, "Well, I want you to sit in this chair," and he faces in a particular direction, and he starts a small fire in the fireplace where he starts to burn some sage and some other herbs, and he calls my family in. He says, "Your family has to be here." So I had three young children at the time, and they're looking with their eyes, you know, wide-eyed at all this, what's going on. And he starts to use a feather fan and to work on me, and you know, I start perspiring profusely. I remember the waist of my pants was completely soaked with perspiration. And then I had this weird feeling. I sort of feel as if somehow he's moved inside. His hands have moved inside my body, which I know is impossible, but I feel them, and it's this feeling of absolute pure love and caring. I can't describe it any other way. I felt utterly safe with him. He's doing this, and he goes, he says, you're holding on. I see you're holding on to someone. Now, I hadn't said a word about this boy who had died the day before. And then he says, if you're holding on to the spirit of a boy, and he needs to leave this life, and you have been clinging to him, and what's happening is he is kicking to get free of you, and that's what this pain in your back is. It's him kicking you like a horse to get away from you. And you have to give him permission to leave. And so we go through this whole thing, and he coaches me, and he says, okay, now we're going to let him go. And I do all of that. And then, just the pain just suddenly fades away, and I'm just left standing there. Interestingly enough, it's a tradition that you sort of give a meal to a medicine man, and it's about 11:30 at night. My friend says, it's traditional for you to prepare a meal. I'm going, look, I was barely standing when I was lying on the floor when you came in. He says, no, you have to do it. So I look and I said, well, how about a spaghetti dinner? That's all I had.
Right.
So there we are at midnight with my kids and my wife and my friend and the Navajo medicine man. We're all sharing in a spaghetti dinner. But it was just an amazing experience as a physician and as a neurosurgeon to be having this experience of a medicine man ministering to me. And the feeling of him moving in through me was just astounding.
That would have made my hair stand up for sure.
Yeah, it did.
Now, you've got a lot of stories in here that we don't have time to cover today. Very interesting stories, and they certainly do make you, question what our beliefs. One of the reasons that you wrote this book, though, is also to empower patients by encouraging them to voice their spiritual needs mm-hmm. when they go through medical help. What do you want to say about that?
We all, when we're facing major surgery or a severe illness, that is when we are most likely to want to reach out to powers greater than ourselves. And that's what I think, spirituality is the desire and the ability to reach out to powers greater than ourselves. It could be family, it could be nature, it could be a cosmic consciousness, it could be God, it's whatever you want to call it. But certainly those powers, I've seen them change patients' recoveries. I've seen them change their, complications and so on. I think if you have two hypothetical patients and you walk into one and you see, you walk in the room and there's family there and there's smiles and there's on the walls, their drawings from the grandchildren get well and their photographs on the bedside table, and you go, okay, this is a human being who's plugged into a tremendous amount of positive energy. And then you go next door, and there's a patient by themselves. And the hospital room is drab, and there's nobody there, and nobody interested in asking you all the questions, and they're isolated, and they're fearful. And if you say to a surgeon, who's going to have the most complication, and who's going to have the stormy postoperative course, it's going to be the latter patient for sure. So obviously, this ability to marshal our emotional resources is enormously important.
You say never, at the end of the book, you have 20 rules to live by. You say never trade quality for quantity of life.
Mm-hmm.
And the will to live is yours. And somewhere, I was just trying to find that right now, but somewhere in here, you also quoted Napoleon, who said that he believes we have a predestined expiration date. How do those two points of view go together? How do we reconcile those? The will to live is yours, but we have a predestined date.
I think we can all be constrained, for example, by statistics. I think one of the most difficult parts about an illness is we hear these statistics and they sort of overwhelm us, and you have to sort of be reminded that a single individual is completely beyond the realm of statistics. We can't predict what's going to happen. And that means, you can be the exception to the rule. You can be the Olympic performance of a lifetime, the gold medal winning patient. And we have to remember that, and we have to have our doctors work with us as a coach rather than raining on our parade, as it were. At the same time, we sort of walk around with this idea of, you know, if I do everything right, and I eat right, and I exercise, and I, you know, I don't smoke, and I do, and I'm not saying you should do any of these things, but we sort of have this feeling of, okay, now I've merited a life free of disease. Well, mm-hmm. that isn't necessarily what's going to happen. To some extent, we are, you know, what's going to happen is already written. You know, you can't dodge the bullet that has your name on it. And, you know, we're going to run into health problems, and there's a certain inevitability, if you will, about what those health problems may turn out to be. And I so often see patients just beating themselves and blaming themselves and saying, well, it's all my fault, or I'm being punished for what I did, you know, and then you go, look, these are natural processes. Saying you're being punished is saying, you know, there's an earthquake that was sent here to kill 30,000 people, but it's specifically here to punish you. That isn't the case. These are natural phenomena, and to some extent we have to say, look, this is out of our control. So much of our anxiety stems from the idea that we can somehow steer events. So I think we need to take a lot of solace from the fact we can beat the odds, and at the same time, some of these things are written, and we're not going to be able to change them.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier that, you know, I was with my father when he died, and you had said in here, you know, we have the will to live, and I do know he willed himself to die because he did not want a quality of life that was probably going to be given to him had he survived. And I remember saying that to the pastor at the funeral, and he kind of raised an eyebrow at me there because you've got two opposing viewpoints. But I do believe that. He even said, I'm sorry it's taking so long. Come on, let's get over. Let's get it on.
We see patients all the time who hang on until their children are there at the bedside, and then they'll say something like, I know you'll be fine, and I want you to know that I have to go, but I know that you will be okay. And then they just let go and go. And I think there really is a will, and we can, to some extent, change it. And I see patient after patient who defy the odds, and I've seen other patients who said, now it's time for me to go. And no matter what we do, we cannot prevent.
Right. Rule number 8 in your 20 Rules to Live By at the back of the book is don't be turned into just another patient. With hospitals getting the way they are these days, with HMOs and, you know, budget cuts on insurance, how do we avoid that? How do we make sure we're seen as a human being and not just another patient?
Well, I think I'm on a wanted list for the American Hospital Association. What I say is you just have to be a wild man or a wild woman. You cannot, don't respect visiting hours. Don't get caught in that silly hospital gown. You go and get your best T-shirt, your sweats. Don't take those paper slippers. Go home and get your pink fluffy bunny shoes. Be yourself, you know. Use that quilt that's your favorite quilt. Put pictures up from your family. Create your own healing ritual. But hospitals try to turn us into nameless, faceless entities. And that is just not good for living things. Variation, individuality is what is nature's rule. And I just think you have to go in there swinging and never stop. I think you have to have your family members support you. I think you need to have one of your family members be a guardian angel who just watches over you, checks every medication, and if necessary, is an SOB, making sure that everything gets done that needs to be done and that mistakes aren't made.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's very, very true. True words there. What would you like to leave our listeners with today? I mean, I think you've shared some really interesting information. What's the one thing you would like them to take away today?
Don't be afraid to reach out. Don't be afraid to harness all everything that you've got as emotion, will, and spirituality to the problem at hand, particularly a medical problem.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us. And I do want to give out your website because there's some information up there. And it is alanhamilton.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's alanhamilton.com.
Yeah, Alan with a double L, Hamilton.com, alanhamilton.com. And the book, again, is The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, The Supernatural and the Healing Power of Hope. Dr. Hamilton, thank you so much for being with us today.
Vicki, thank you.
And I want to thank each of you for tuning in today, for joining us today. If you've got questions or feedback on today's show, you know where to reach me. You can call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or you can reach me through our website at conversationslive.net. I want to say thank you to the J&B Group for their continued support of Conversations Live. It's very much appreciated. And please join me next Monday at noon when we'll be talking with a woman who made a dynamic change in her life at the age of 53. Her story shows how it's never too late to live your dream. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for spending this hour with me on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, freelance writer Gene Eck in I'm Happier to Know You. Middle-aged, recently divorced, and facing critical midlife issues, Jean did what any sensible woman would do. She moved to Egypt. I'm Happier to Know You is the memoir of how an ancient culture changed Jean Eck's life and taught her to pursue her dreams. Both timely and timeless, it's the story of how one woman learned to live life at its fullest and honor her intuition. Most importantly, Jean Eck's work imparts the message that peace is built upon loving and healing ourselves. That's coming next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Walk like an Egyptian. Views.